If only you could navigate. If only you could steer. A wave washed over the deck. Rincewind and Twoflower looked at each other. Keep bailing, they screamed in unison and reached for the buckets. After a while, Twoflower's peevish voice filtered up from the waterlogged cabin.
I don't see how it's my fault, he said.
He handed up another bucket, which the wizard tipped over the side. You were supposed to be on watch, snapped Rincewind.
I saved us from the slavers, remember? Said Twoflower.
I'd rather be a slave than a corpse, replied the wizard. He straightened up and looked out to sea. He appeared puzzled. He was a somewhat different Rincewind from the one that escaped the fire of Ankh Morpork some 6 months before. More scarred, for one thing, and much more travelled. He had visited the Hublands, discovered the curious folkways of many colourful peoples, invariably obtaining more scars in the process, and had even, for a never-to-be-forgotten few days, sailed on the legendary dehydrated ocean at the heart of the incredibly dry desert known as the Great Neff. On a colder and wetter sea, he had seen floating mountains of ice. He had ridden on an imaginary dragon. He had very nearly said the most powerful spell on the disc. There was definitely less horizon than there ought to be. Said Rincewind.
I said nothing's worse than slavery, said Twoflower.
His mouth opened as the wizard flung his bucket far out to sea and sat down heavily on the waterlogged deck, his face a grey mask.
Look, I'm sorry I steered us into the reef, but this boat doesn't seem to want to sink, and we're bound to strike land sooner or later, said Twoflower comfortingly. This current must go somewhere.
Look at the horizon, said Rincewind in a monotone. Twoflower squinted.
It looks all right, he said after a while. Admittedly, there seems to be less than there usually is, but...
That's because of the rim fall, said Rincewind. We're being carried over the edge of the world. There was a long silence, broken only by the lapping of the waves as the foundering ship spun slowly in the current. It was already quite strong. That's probably why we hit that reef, Rincewind added. We've got pulled off course during the night.
Would you like something to eat?
Asked Twoflower. He began to rummage through the bundle that he'd tied onto the rail, out of the damp. Don't you understand, snarled Rincewind, we are going over the edge, goddammit.
Can't we do anything about it?
No.
Well, then I can't see any sense in panicking, said Twoflower calmly.
I knew we shouldn't have come this far edgewise, complained Rincewind to the sky. I wish
I had my picture box, said Twoflower, but it's back on that slaver ship with the rest of the luggage, and...
You won't need luggage where we're going, said Rincewind. He sagged and stared moodily at a distant whale that had carelessly strayed into the rimward current and was now struggling against it. There was a line of white on the foreshortened horizon, and the wizard fancied he could hear a distant roaring.
What happens after the ship goes over the rimfall, said Twoflower.
Who knows?
Well, in that case, perhaps we'll just sail on through space and land on another world.
A faraway look came into the little man's eyes.
I like that, he said.
Rincewind snorted. The sun rose in the sky, looking noticeably bigger this close to the edge. They stood with their backs against the mast, busy with their own thoughts. Every so often, one or other would pick up a bucket and do a bit of desultory bailing, for no very intelligent reason. The sea around them seemed to be getting crowded. Rincewind noticed several tree trunks keeping station with them, and just below the surface the water was alive with fish of all sorts. Of course, the current must be teeming with food washed from the continents near the hub. He wondered what kind of life it would be, having to keep swimming all the time to stay exactly in the same place. Pretty similar to his own, he decided. He spotted a small green frog, which was paddling desperately in the grip of the inexorable current. To Twoflower's amazement, he found a paddle and carefully extended it towards the little amphibian, which scrambled onto it gratefully. A moment later, a pair of jaws broke the water and snapped impotently at the spot where it had been swimming. The frog looked up at Rincewind from the cradle of his hands, then bit him thoughtfully on the thumb. Twoflower giggled. Rincewind tucked the frog away in a pocket and pretended he hadn't heard.
All very humanitarian, but why? Said Twoflower. It'll all be the same in an hour.
Because, said Rincewind vaguely, and did a bit of bailing. Spray was being thrown up now, and the current was so strong that waves were forming and breaking all around them. It all seemed unnaturally warm. There was a hot, golden haze on the sea. The roaring was louder now. A squid, bigger than anything Rincewind had seen before, broke the surface a few hundred yards away and thrashed madly with its tentacles before sinking away. Something else that was large and fortunately unidentifiable howled in the mist. A whole squadron of flying fish tumbled up in a cloud of rainbow-edged droplets and managed to gain a few yards before dropping back and being swept in an eddy. They were running out of world. Rincewind dropped his bucket and snatched at the mast as the roaring final end of everything raced towards them.
"I must see this," said Twoflower, half-falling and half-diving towards the prow.
Something hard and unyielding smacked into the hull, which spun 90 degrees and came side-on to the invisible obstacle. Then it stopped suddenly, and a wash of cold sea foam cascaded over the deck, so that for a few seconds Rincewind was under several feet of boiling green water. He began to scream, and then the underwater world became the deep, clanging purple colour of fading consciousness, because it was about at this point that Rincewind started to drown. He awoke with his mouth full of burning liquid, and when he swallowed, the searing pain in his throat jerked him into full consciousness. The boards of a boat pressed into his back, and Twoflower was looking down at him with an expression of deep concern. Rincewind groaned and sat up. This turned out to be a mistake. The edge of the world was a few feet away. Beyond it, at a level just below that of the lip of the endless rimfall, was something altogether magical. Some 70 miles away, and well beyond the tug of the rim current, a dhow, with the red sails typical of a freelance slaver, drifted aimlessly through the velvety twilight. The crew, such as remained, were clustered on the foredeck, surrounding the men working feverishly on the raft. The captain, a thick-set man who wore the elbow turbans typical of a great Neff tribesman, was much travelled and had seen many strange people and curious things, many of which he had subsequently enslaved or stolen. He had begun his career as a sailor on the dehydrated ocean in the heart of the disk's driest desert. Water on the disk has an uncommon fourth state caused by intense heat combining with the strange desiccating effects of octarine light. It dehydrates, leaving a silvery residue like free-flowing sand through which a well-designed hull can glide with ease. The dehydrated ocean is a strange place, but not so strange as its fish. The captain had never before been really frightened. Now he was terrified.
"I can't hear anything,"
he muttered to the first mate. The mate peered into the gloom.
"Perhaps it fell overboard,"
he suggested hopefully. As if in answer, there came a furious pounding from the oar-deck below their feet and the sound of splintering wood. The crewmen drew together fearfully, brandishing axes and torches. They probably wouldn't dare to use them, even if the monster came rushing towards them. Before its terrible nature had been truly understood, several men had attacked it with axes, whereupon it had turned aside from its single-minded searching of the ship and had either chased them overboard or had eaten them. The captain was not quite certain. The thing looked like an ordinary wooden sea chest, a bit larger than usual maybe, but not suspiciously so. But while it sometimes seemed to contain things like old socks and miscellaneous luggage, at other times, and he shuddered, it seemed to have... He tried not to think about it. It was just that the men who had been drowned overboard had probably been more fortunate than those it had caught. He tried not to think about it. There had been teeth. Teeth like white wooden gravestones, and a tongue red as mahogany. He tried not to think about it. It didn't work. But he thought bitterly about one thing. This was going to be the last time he rescued ungrateful drowning men in mysterious circumstances. Slavery was better than sharks, wasn't it? And then they had escaped, and when his sailors had investigated their big chest, how had they appeared in the middle of an untroubled ocean sitting on a big chest anyway? And it had bitten... He tried not to think about it again, but he found himself wondering what would happen when the damn thing realized that its owner wasn't on board any longer.
"Raft's ready, Lord," said the first mate.
"Into the water with it," shouted the captain. "Get aboard and fire the ship."
After all, another ship wouldn't be too hard to come by, he philosophized. But a man might have to wait a long time in that paradise the Mullahs advertised before he was granted another life. Let the magical box eat lobsters. Some pirates achieved immortality by great deeds of cruelty or derring-do. Some achieved immortality by amassing great wealth. But the captain had long ago decided that he would, on the whole, prefer to achieve immortality by not dying.
"What the hell is that?" demanded Rincewind.
"It's beautiful," said Twoflower, beatifically.
"I'll decide about that when I know what it is," said the wizard.
"It is the Rimbo," said a voice immediately behind his left ear, "and you are fortunate indeed to be looking at it from above, at any rate."
The voice was accompanied by a gust of cold, fishy breath. Rincewind sat quite still.
"Two-flower," he said.
"Yes?"
"If I turn around, what will I see?"
"His name is Tethys. He says he's a sea troll. This is his boat. He rescued us," explained Two-flower. "Will you look around now?"
"Not just at the moment, thank you. So why aren't we going over the edge, then?"
asked Rincewind with glassy calmness.
"Because your boat hit the circumference," said the voice behind him, in tones that made Rincewind imagine submarine chasms and lurking things in coral reefs.
"The circumference?" he repeated.
"Yes, it runs along the edge of the world," said the unseen troll.
Above the roar of the waterfall, Rincewind thought he could make out the splash of oars. He hoped they were oars.
"Ah, you mean the circumference," said Rincewind. "The circumference makes the edge of things."
"So does the circumference," said the troll.
"He means this," said Two-flower, pointing down.
Rincewind's eyes followed the finger, dreading what they might see. Hubwards of the boat was a rope suspended a few feet above the surface of the white water. The boat was attached to it, moored yet mobile, by a complicated arrangement of pulleys and little wooden wheels. They ran along the rope as the unseen rower propelled the craft along the very lip of the rimfall. That explained one mystery. But what supported the rope? Rincewind peered along its length and saw a stout wooden post sticking up out of the water a few yards ahead. As he watched, the boat neared it and then passed it, the little wheels clacking neatly around it in a groove obviously cut for the purpose. Rincewind also noticed that smaller ropes hung down from the main rope at intervals of a yard or so. He turned back to Two-flower.
"I can see what it is," he said. "But what is it?"
Two-flower shrugged. Behind Rincewind, the sea troll said,
"Up ahead is my house. We'll talk more when we are there. Now I must row."
Rincewind found that looking ahead meant that he would have to turn and find out what the sea troll actually looked like, and he wasn't sure he wanted to do that yet. He looked at the Rimbo instead. It hung in the mists a few lengths beyond the edge of the world, appearing only at morning and evening, when the light of the disk's little orbiting sun shone past the massive bulk of Great Arthuin, the world turtle, and struck the disk's magical field at exactly the right angle. A double rainbow coruscated into being. Close into the lip of the rimfall were the seven lesser colours, sparkling and dancing in the spray of the dying seas. But they were pale in comparison to the wider band that floated beyond them, not deigning to share the same spectrum. It was the king colour, of which all the lesser colours are merely partial and wishy-washy reflections. It was octarine, the colour of magic. It was alive and glowing and vibrant, and it was the undisputed pigment of the imagination, because wherever it appeared it was a sign that mere matter was a servant of the powers of the magical mind. It was enchantment itself. But Rincewind always thought it looked a sort of greenish-purple. After a while, a small speck on the rim of the world resolved itself into an ayot or crag, so perilously perched that the waters of the fall swirled around it at the start of their long drop. A driftwood shanty had been built on it, and Rincewind saw that the top rope of the circumfence climbed over the rocky island on a number of iron stakes and actually passed through the shack by a small round window. He learned later that this was so that the troll could be alerted to the arrival of any salvage on his stretch of the circumfence by means of a series of small bronze bells balanced delicately on the rope. A crude floating stockade had been built out of rough timber on the hubward side of the island. It contained one or two hulks and quite a large amount of floating wood in the form of planks, bulks, and even whole natural tree trunks, some still sporting green leaves. This close to the edge, the disk's magical field was so intense that a hazy corona flickered across everything as raw illusion spontaneously discharged itself. With a last few squeaky jerks, the boat slid up against a small driftwood jetty. As it grounded itself and formed a circuit, Rincewind felt all the familiar sensations of a huge occult aura. Oily, bluish-tasting, and smelling of tin. All around them, pure, unfocused magic was sleeting soundlessly into the world. The wizard and Two-flower scrambled onto the planking, and for the first time Rincewind saw the troll.
It wasn't half so dreadful as he'd imagined. "Hmm," said his imagination after a while. It wasn't that the troll was horrifying. Instead of the rotting, betentacled monstrosity that he had been expecting, Rincewind found himself looking at a rather squat but not particularly ugly old man who would quite easily have passed for normal on any city street, always provided that other people on the street were used to seeing old men who were apparently composed of water and very little else. It was as if the ocean had decided to create life without going through all that tedious business of evolution, and had simply formed a part of itself into a biped and sent it walking squishily up the beach. The troll was a pleasant, translucent blue colour. As Rincewind stared, a small shoal of silver fish flashed across its chest.
"It's rude to stare," said the troll.
Its mouth opened with a little crest of foam and shut again in exactly the same way that water closes over a stone. "Is it? Why?" asked Rincewind. "How does he hold himself together?" his mind screamed at him. "Why doesn't he spill?"
"If you will follow me to my house, I will find you food and a change of clothing," said the troll solemnly.
He set off over the rocks without turning to see if they would follow him. After all, where else could they go? It was getting dark and a chilly, damp breeze was blowing over the edge of the world. Already the transient rimbo had faded and the mists above the waterfall were beginning to thin.
"Come on," said Rincewind, grabbing Two Flowers' elbow. But the tourist didn't appear to want to move.
"Come on," the wizard repeated.
"When it gets really dark, do you think we'll be able to look down and see Great Artuin, the world turtle?" asked Two Flower, staring at the rolling clouds.
"I hope not," said Rincewind. "I really do. Now, let's go, shall we?"
Two Flower followed him reluctantly into the shack. The troll had lit a couple of lamps and was sitting comfortably in a rocking chair. He got to his feet as they entered and poured two cups of a green liquid from a tall pitcher. In the dim light he appeared to phosphoresce, in the manner of warm seas on velvety summer nights. Just to add a rock gloss to Rincewind's dull terror, he seemed to be several inches taller, too. Most of the furniture in the room appeared to be boxes.
Really great place you've got here," said Rincewind. "Ethnic."
He reached for a cup and looked at the green pool shimmering inside it. "It had better be drinkable," he thought, "because I'm going to drink it." He swallowed. It was the same stuff Two Flower had given him in the rowing boat, but at the time his mind had ignored it because there were more pressing matters. Now he had the leisure to savour the taste. Rincewind's mouth twisted. He whimpered a little. One of his legs came up convulsively and caught him painfully in the chest. Two Flower swirled his own drink thoughtfully while he considered the flavour.
"Galen Livid," he said. "The fermented Vool nut drink they freeze distill in my home country. A certain smoky quality. Piquant. From the western plantations in, Rehigreed province, yes? Next year's harvest, I fancy? From the colour? May I ask how you came by it?"
Plants on the disc, while including the categories known commonly as annuals, which were sown this year to come up later this year, biennials, sown this year to grow next year, and perennials, sown this year to grow until further notice, also included a few rare re-annuals, which, because of an unusual four-dimensional twist in their genes, could be planted this year to come up last year. The Vool nut vine was particularly exceptional in that it could flourish as many as 8 years prior to its seed actually being sown. Vool nut wine was reputed to give certain drinkers an insight into the future, which was, from the nut's point of view, the past. Strange, but true.
"All things drift into the circumference in time," said the troll, gnomically, gently rocking in his chair. "My job is to recover the flotsam, timber, of course, and ships, barrels of wine, bales of cloth. You."
Light dawned inside Rincewind's head.
"It's a net, isn't it? You've got a net right on the edge of the sea."
"The circumference," nodded the troll. Ripples ran across his chest.
Rincewind looked out into the phosphorescent darkness that surrounded the island and grinned inanely.
"Of course," he said. "Amazing. You could sink piles and attach it to reefs, and, good grief, the net would have to be very strong."
"It is," said Tethys.
"It could be extended for a couple of miles if you found enough rocks and things," said the wizard.
10,000 miles. I just patrol this league."
That's a third of the way round the disk. Tethys sloshed a little as he nodded again. While the two men helped themselves to some more of the green wine, he told them about the circumference, the great effort that had been made to build it, and the ancient and wise kingdom of Krull, which had constructed it several centuries before, and the seven navies that patrolled it constantly to keep it in repair and bring its salvage back to Krull, and the manner in which Krull had become a land of leisure ruled by the most learned seekers after knowledge, and the way in which they sought constantly to understand in every possible particular the wondrous complexity of the universe, and the way in which sailors, marooned on the circumference, were turned into slaves, and usually had their tongues cut out. After some interjections at this point, he spoke, in a friendly way, on the futility of force, the impossibility of escaping from the island except by boat to one of the other 380 isles that lay between the island and Krull itself, or by leaping over the edge, and the high merit of muteness in comparison to, for example, death. There was a pause. The muted night roar of the rimfall only served to give the silence a heavier texture. Then the rocking chair started to creak again. Tethys seemed to have grown alarmingly during the monologue.
"There is nothing personal in all this," he added. "I, too, am a slave. If you try to overpower me, I shall have to kill you, of course, but I won't take any particular pleasure in it."
Rincewind looked at the shimmering fists that rested lightly in the troll's lap. He suspected they could strike with all the force of a tsunami.
"I don't think you understand," explained Twoflower. "I am a citizen of the Golden Empire. I am sure Krull would not wish to incur the displeasure of the Emperor."
"How will the Emperor know?" asked the troll. "Do you think you're the first person from the Empire who has ended up on the circumference?"
"I won't be a slave," shouted Rincewind. I'd jump over the edge first."
He was amazed at the sound of his own voice.
"Would you, though?"
asked the troll. The rocking chair flicked back against the wall, and one blue arm caught the wizard round the waist. A moment later the troll was striding out of the shack, with Rincewind gripped carelessly in one fist. He did not stop until he came to the rimward edge of the island. Rincewind squealed.
"Stop that, or I really will throw you over the edge," snapped the troll. "I'm holding you, aren't I? Look."
Rincewind looked. In front of him was a soft black night, whose mist-muted stars glowed peacefully, but his eyes turned downwards, drawn by some irresistible fascination. It was midnight on the disk, and so therefore the sun was far, far below, swinging slowly under great Artuin's vast and frosty plastron. Rincewind tried a last attempt to fix his gaze on the tips of his boots, which were protruding over the rim of the rock, but the sheer drop wrenched it away. On either side of him, two glittering curtains of water hurtled towards infinity as the sea swept around the island on its way to the long fall. 100 yards below the wizard, the largest sea salmon he had ever seen flicked itself out of the foam in a wild, jerky, and ultimately hopeless leap. Then it fell back, over and over, into the golden underworld light. Huge shadows grew out of that light like pillars supporting the roof of the universe. Hundreds of miles below him, the wizard made out the shape of something, the edge of something. Like those curious little pictures where the silhouette of an ornate glass suddenly becomes the outline of two faces, the scene beneath him flipped into a whole new terrifying perspective. Because down there was the head of an elephant, as big as a reasonably sized continent. One mighty tusk cut like a mountain against the golden light, trailing a widening shadow towards the stars. The head was slightly tilted, and a huge ruby eye might almost have been a red supergiant that had managed to shine at noonday. Below the elephant, Rincewind swallowed and tried not to think, below the elephant there was nothing but the distant, painful disk of the sun, and sweeping slowly past it was something that, for all its city-sized scales, its crater pox, its lunar cragginess, was indubitably a flipper.
"Shall I let go?" suggested the troll.
"Nah," said Rincewind, straining backwards.
"I have lived here on the edge for 5 years, and I have not had the courage," boomed Tethys. "Nor have you, if I'm any judge."
He stepped back, allowing Rincewind to fling himself on the ground.
Twoflower strolled up to the rim and peered over.
"Fantastic," he said. "If only I had my picture box. What else is down there? I mean, if you jumped off, what would you see?"